This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moore pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone Bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website, as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. Hey there, friends. Welcome back. Welcome to the show. This is episode number 104. And this month, we are featuring my conversation with the incredible George Porter Jr. Yes, the one and only New Orleans bass player and one of the original founding members of The Meters, one of the great, great instrumental groups of all time. One of the great groups of all time, let's face it. Back in the 60s, when these guys were first recording and prolifically putting out records, really the only other band doing remotely what they were doing was Booker T and the MGs in Memphis. These guys were working out of New Orleans. And, you know, coming out of like basically cover bands, I found really interesting to find out. And they were playing a bunch of soul and R&B and New Orleans standards in various bands, which you'll hear about. And the Meters kind of came together as a cover band, really. And they started playing and doing sessions for the incredible Alan Toussaint, who was a producer and artist. He died a couple of years ago and was a terrific artist in his own right, but he was also a noted producer and arranger. A lot of people know him as the guy that arranged all the great horn parts for the band, but he also produced all kinds of classic New Orleans R&B and soul sides back in the 60s and 70s. And George was a big part of his sound. The Meters became like Toussaint's house band and would go and do sessions for him all the time. And during those sessions, the Meters were born. The engineer just sort of rolled tape, and apparently Toussaint stayed out of the way, and these guys just laid down these tunes, which are deceptively simple. Like, everyone kind of thinks they can play Sissy Strut, but they can't. They don't really know how it goes. And it's just one of those tunes. It's one of those grooves, and their songs are just chock full of these deceptively simple grooves, which are so unique and so heavy and sound amazing to this day. I love them. The drums are all sort of hard panned off to the right, usually, and George Porter on the bass, he's also on the right. It's funny. It's weird how these, I didn't really notice until I listened with headphones, but that's how those records are sort of laid out. And I'm guessing that has to do with the fact that they were just recording live, probably to a 3 or 4 track, and instruments were just getting shoved off to one side or the other in a stereo mix. Anyway, they put out a bunch of records starting in 1969, The Meters. If you don't know any of these records, you got to go check them out. Then there's followed by Look a Pie Pie, Stratton, Cabbage Alley, Fire on the Bayou. So many great records. Some of them are vocal songs, some are not. So the original Meters lineup was George on bass, Zigaboo Modaliste on drums, Art Neville on keys. He sadly passed away a couple of years ago. That was a huge loss to the New Orleans community. Leo Nocentelli on guitar. Eventually Cyril Neville joined. I don't know if he officially joined or if he was just there a lot, but he was sort of in the band. And other people came and went, but that was the core band that made all those great records through the 60s and mostly the 70s, really. And so through the Alan Toussaint connection, they played on some amazing records, too, for Dr. John. They played on Paul McCartney record. They played on that killer Robert Palmer record, Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley. Do you guys know that one? That's a monster record. It's got some Little Feat people and some Meters people all mixed together, which is cool. The Meters kind of disintegrated in 79 or 80, and George went on to play with the Neville Brothers. He did some stuff with Keith Richards, and he started his own bands, and he's been playing around New Orleans for decades, and you can still see him. I saw him there a couple of times. And so he had the George Porter Trio, or I think it was called the Porter Trio at some point. And he's got his most recent band, which is called The Running Partners. And The Running Partners just put together a new record, which we talk about at the beginning of this interview, because we actually did this a couple of months ago when he was just sort of wrapping up the recording of that. And it's called Crying for Hope. So make sure you check out all the Meters stuff, all the George Porter Trio, and all the Running Partner records. So I sort of met George about 10 years ago. Well, I did meet him, but it was very fleeting. It was at the Calgary Folk Festival, and he was up there playing with, I can't remember what the band was actually called. I think it was called the New Orleans All-Stars or something like that. And the rumor had it was that he was up playing with that band and he broke a string on his bass. And the word on the street was that that string had been on that bass since the 80s or something. And he didn't want a new string for obvious reasons, like partly because it would feel weird, I guess, and partly because it would sound weird. And so he got a guy from the festival to drive around to the vintage guitar stores in Calgary and find a bass from the 70s that had strings from the 70s on it. Now, I don't know if that's true, but that's what I heard going around the festival. And when I met him in the van, I didn't ask him about that. But that was what I heard happened, and that's cool. And I should have asked him here today, but I also forgot to bring that up. Anyway, that was my experience running into George Porter Jr. at the Calgary Folk Festival. Now, we all know that one of these days, live music is going to come back. It'll be back in full force in New Orleans, of course. And if you ever find yourself down that way, you should check out George and one of his many projects. You can find out information on all the stuff that he's up to at georgeporterjr.com. That's georgeporterjr.com. And I should point out that his new album, Running Partners, Crying for Hope, is technically listed, if you're looking for it in Spotify or Amazon Music or Apple Music or whatever, it's George Porter Jr. and Runnin' Partners. And that's Runnin' with the apostrophe instead of the G, and Partners is with a D, P-A-R-D-N-E-R-S. So it's George Porter Jr. and Runnin' Partners, Crying for Hope. Go find it. So before we get going here, I would just like to thank a few people that have kicked in over the last few weeks since the last couple of episodes came out with Peter Rowan. They have contributed either by signing up to the Patreon account or with a one-time donation. Those people are Glenn Jackson, George Wells, Gene Solomon, Leonard Swanson, Mike Dolphin, and Jeff Lang over in Australia. Do you guys know Jeff Lang? He's a monster guitar player. And I met him like 20 some odd years ago. He came to Vancouver and opened for my hippie rock band, I guess, at the time. And we ended up jamming and having a great old time. And Jeff came a lot to Canada. He's a monster player. Go check him out. Anyway, thank you so much to all those people. I couldn't do this show without the support, and I greatly appreciate all of it. Thank you. All right, so let's get on with the show. This is my conversation with the incredible George Porter Jr. Well, thanks so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been, I've been hoping to get you on this show for a while, actually. And man, you've just made so much great music through your life. I hoped we could sort of dive in and talk about a bunch of it.
Sure enough.
Looks like you got a cool little studio set up in your house there. Tell me what you're up to over there.
We've been recording. I just completed the Runnin' Partners upcoming CD. The title is going to be Crying for Hope.
Okay.
And we just released it on my birthday, on my 73rd birthday, the day after Christmas, the single, Crying for Hope. But, you know, in the house here, I have, you know, I'm using a iMac computer. I'm running Pro Tools, the newest version, Pro Tools. Yeah. And we've been recording in the cloud, you know, with my keyboardist, Mike Limbler, and Chris Atkins, guitarist, and Terrence Houston, in their own studios, you know. So we've been getting the work done. You know, I was really pleased with the fact that we was able, that technology had been around for a while, but Mike and I have been having it for over 2 years, but we never used it. And, you know, when 19 came along, we just decided, you know, I said, man, why don't we try using this program that we never we never ever used, you know, or it's part of a program that the cloud part, you know. And he said, okay, give me a day, let me do the homework, and then I'll get back to you. And you know, he got back to me the next day, and we started uploading music, and we completed the record about, it's been about 4 weeks now.
So are you actually using that Pro Tools cloud? Is that the cloud you're talking about?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I could actually never really get that working properly. So,
well, you know, it had a lot to do with, when we first started the sessions, both of us was running, 2000 something.
Yeah.
And it didn't work really well with that. Until we did the upgrade, and we upgraded to the latest Pro Tools that was out. Now, I can't remember which is 17 or something, or 11, I believe it's 11, 2011.
Okay.
And that's when it started working. And, you know, had no trouble at all with that outfit.
Well, that's good to know. It might be a thing where like both people have to have the same version. I'd never even really thought about that.
I think that might have a lot to do with it, because you know, we may say that because Chris Atkins had Mike and I started doing the projects, you know, because he's kind of like my band leader. I always tell everybody that Mike Limbler is my band leader, my music director. And Mike and I got on the same page, the same day, and we started working. Then by the time we invited Chris to come work on the guitar parts, you know, Chris has not gotten to that newest version, and actually he had to go up two steps.
Oh, okay.
Because he was like two steps down.
And that's probably the thing then.
Yeah, once he got up to, once we were all three of them on the same system, you know.
Then it worked.
We worked and had no problems and no shutdowns. I believe also when COVID first happened, I think they had to, the Pro Tools had to do some work on it. Yeah. And because, you know, everybody ran to that format, you know.
Yeah.
And was probably crashing their system, you know. And they, by the time they got, it took them about 3 or 4 days. And, you know, before Mike told me, say, I think Pro Tools fine, because Mike was, he was conversing back and forth with, with Avid, you know, yeah. And it got it all. It got all worked out. It's worked out.
Oh,
and
that's
I'm
cool.
I'm really pleased with the final product. It came out really good. I think it's my best record to date.
So before we talk about some of the history stuff, I'm going to guess that for you this year, like the last 12 months, have been like the least amount of live work you've done probably since the early 60s. I don't know if I'm right about that. I don't know if you ever took a bit of a break or a time off from touring or from gigging, but that would be my guess. Like, how's that been for you as an adjustment, and how are you liking the whole like the online thing as opposed to playing live?
I believe you know, I kind of got into the recording aspect of music, you know, way back in the early 70s, what Cosmo Metassa was kind of pretty much was a role model for me. Him and Roberta, I would go over to CSAN Studios and just hang out with them, you know, and watch how that process was done, and you know, and how to get information on the tape and also how to get it off the tape, you know. So I was always intrigued with that. So when COVID came down the line, and we got stuck at home. I had no problems with, you know, wanting to come up in here and just hang out in the studio and just, you know, get back into the working stages of the whole system, the studio idea, because, you know, being on the road as much as we were, you know, I learned things in the program and go out on the road and come back home a month and a half later and forgot what I learned, you know. So
totally.
So being able to be with the program for, you know, for 8 months, it's really good. Now I just I've kind of, like I said, we finished the session about 3-4 weeks ago. So I kind of walked away from the studio and been looking at television, lots of television.
Yeah.
And you know, so probably hopefully next week I'll come back up here and start working on the Porter Trios record, you know, which is you know, which is basically recorded, just needed to, you know, to tweak a few things, find a comfortable vocal a vocal track that I can live with, you know. And that's usually the hardest part of the recording thing for me, is just finding a vocal track that I could sing and play at the same time. Because, you know, we do the music and I put down these great bass lines and then come put the vocal down and then listen to it and say, oh, I can't sing. I can't play both of those. So then I had to go back and simplify either the vocal track or simplify the bass line, you know.
And are you doing all the engineering yourself, or do you have somebody that comes over and does that for you?
No, here at home, I'm doing all my engineering. Yes, there's Michael is the only person that's been in this room since COVID, and that was because the iMac back behind me is the new hard boy on the block.
Okay,
and I got that one and we upgraded. So I took all the system off of the old iMac and put it over onto this one. And again, Mike is the tech. So no one else has been my granddaughter, my daughter's been here, but not up here.
Yeah.
This space up here belongs to me.
Have you done any gigging at all? Like, has there been any like online shows or like any outdoor shows around New Orleans that you've been involved in? Or have you just like stayed home and not done anything like that?
We've done a trio gig, two of those. It was the Maple Leaf and Exile.
Played the Maple Leaf.
Yeah, but it was. But we actually played at a club down the road from them called Southport.
Okay.
Southport Music Hall. on Southport's porch. They have a big porch and a nice big parking lot.
Okay.
So, I think it was limited to, I think maybe 50 people. Oh, it was 100. There were 100 people, but they had it spread it out really well. The first time we played, it was to open air. The second time they had built a tent because it got cold. Okay.
Really?
Yeah. But you know, my girlfriend told him that, just said, no, Porter's not playing inside anywhere. You know, and the tent is inside. So, you know, so they took the back off the tent behind us and that side panel off. So there was, so we had fresh air running through us. And it wasn't that cold, but, you know, it was cold, but it wasn't that cold enough to say, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't play this gig.
Right.
I did a gig with the Running Partners for my birthday, December 26th. But that was inside, and there was nobody, you know, no one present. It was just it was just us and the video people. That was a live stream.
Yeah. So you've done a few things.
I've done maybe five or six, and I played a wedding out in the courtyard of the Ace Hotel the day after my birthday, the 27th. It was pretty cool. It was fun, you know. It's just a trio to 10 people, you know.
Okay. Wow. Exclusive gig, man.
Yeah, man. And it was really good, very well paid. You know, it was really nice, you know.
So tell me the current lineup of your trio. Is that like Russell Batiste and those guys?
No. The Porter Trio is basically, and how it came about was when the guitarist for the Running Partners, Brent Anderson, left the band 3 years ago, to almost 3.5 years ago. And when he left the band, I kind of like, you know, we had started doing a Monday night thing up at the Maple Leaf with just the three of us before Brent left the band.
Okay.
And I just said, well, you know, let's put all our energies into this project. You know, let's just play as a trio for a while. And we did for almost a year that we just played as a trio. But then the booking agency, you know, was calling me up saying, man, I got gigs for Running Partners. You need to put this together, you know.
Yeah.
So Chris Atkins, you know, came across the desk. Leslie Smith actually told me about Chris. And, you know, so we contacted Chris and he said, man, but I would love to do this gig, man. You know, so I sent in the material and we had no rehearsals. The very first gig was his rehearsal.
Yeah.
And he came prepared, really prepared.
Really? Nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah. So so the Running Partners band today, as of today, consists of Michael Limler on keyboards, Terrence Houston on drums, and Chris Atkins on guitar.
And have you played with all those guys for a long time?
Michael Limler has been in the band for pretty close to 25 years.
Okay. So I've seen you with those guys.
Well, yeah. And Terrence Houston was in the band for at least 10 years now.
Okay.
And so, you know, it was almost a natural involvement from Running Partners to the trio, because the Porter Trio was Michael Limler, Terrence Houston, and myself.
Okay.
And basically, we were kind of acting, you know, acting out musically as a jam band, you know, with no song list to start out with. We would start the gig musically, and
cool.
2.5 hours later, we would be saying, okay,
take a break.
And so I had always made a habit of listening to the second set of gigs on my way home. And I called Michael up one morning, like maybe Tuesday afternoon or something like that. I said, man, I've been listening to these gigs, bro. We need to come up in the studio and record some of this stuff, you know? So that's what we did. We came in, started recording.
With a plan or just totally like off the cuff?
Well, some off the cuff, but, you know, with some of the ideas that was happening on those Monday nights.
Okay.
We just came in the studio and then kind of took
that's that, a cool way to do it.
That 12 minute jam and turned it into, you know, maybe a 5 to 6 minute piece of music, you know?
Right, right.
So we did that. We got about 19 songs done.
Wicked.
And then, you know, like I said, booking agents was really, you know, said, man, running partners, I got gigs. We need to put y'all out on the road. So we left the studio, went back on the road. And, yeah. you know, then we was out for almost a year, and then COVID came along. And, okay, so now we're out of work. not wanting to work, actually, you know, because it was kind of crazy. And, so that's when I called up Michael and said, man, let's finish this Running Partners record and add Chris to the mix.
So you took the tracks that you'd done as a trio.
Correct. No. We took the original recordings that we had done of Running Partners like 5 years ago with Brent Anderson on guitar that was never released.
Yeah.
They just were sitting in the can over here. And we revisited those 20 some odd tracks.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And then picked out of those 20 some tracks, I think we did six, maybe seven songs that was originally recorded with Brent Anderson. And then while that process was going on, I just started writing some new stuff, you know.
Right.
And so then there were five more additional songs, or maybe six more additional songs. And we broke it down to mean 12 songs.
Okay. And so pre-COVID, where were you guys recording? Like, do you have a favorite spot in New Orleans to record, or are there a ton of options, or what's the recording scene like there now?
It's my home.
Okay.
It's a very functional 32 channel. Well, it's probably, I have unlimited channels because I'm using the newest Pro Tools. And my desk is a Presonus 32 channel desk, but in the room here, we never ever use more than, I think we use 10 tracks on the drums.
Okay.
14 tracks on keyboard and keyboard world. So 14 inputs and two baseline inputs. It's never used 16, more than 16 at a time.
Yeah,
and
you don't need that.
And we never record guitar with the rest of the band because, you know, keyboards and bass could go in direct. And so there's no bleed on the drums.
Right, right.
But I noticed when we was fine tuning some of the overheads that you can hear my strings. Uh-huh. Terrence's overheads and some of his quieter parts.
So that's, you know, all right, man.
Yeah, so, you know, so we have a guy named Tracy Freeman, man, who's really good at isolating things like that,
and
cutting them out, you know. and so it's good, you know. And like I said, Michael is excellent at being a part of that technical world of, you know, putting stuff in time. Because, like, when I write these songs, I don't write them to a click track. I just write off of how I'm feeling at the time. Some of them is like stuff I take off of. I was downstairs a couple of times and just used my iPhone, recorded the track, and then brought that up to the studio and dropped it in the Pro Tools. And then forwarded it to Michael, and then Michael would grid it and put it all, piece it all together. And then he'll send it back to me and say, okay, here's all the parts that you did. How you want them to lay, you know, and that's how the songs were constructed.
Okay, that's cool. So I didn't realize that your room is big enough there to do like full band stuff. So it's everybody cranked up in there. That's great.
Over to my right over here, the drum kit is set up against the wall, and to his right, my keyboard is sitting there, and then I have a second keyboard rig that's just by itself. It's just a piano, grand sounds. And then where I'm sitting right here is usually where I'm at, you know, right in front of the console playing my bass.
Okay.
But yeah.
So bass wise, tell me a little bit about, like, maybe we can use the actual bass as a way to kind of travel back in time a little bit. But as of right now, like currently, what do you still use like a straight up Fender Precision? Or I think that was always your axe of choice, right? Back in the day?
The P bass was my axe of choice for probably 40 plus years. While on tour with Government Mule, the other bass player that was on that tour, Greg Arzab, had a deal with Lakeland, and I had my P bass on the road, and I had bought this back. My backup bass was a No Name bass. It was a Warmoth neck and a body that I had put together. It was a good playing instrument. Sounded really wonderful, a wonderful sounding instrument. But Greg said, man, we can't pull it out here playing a bass with No Name on it. That's disgusting, man, And so he had called Dan Lakeland and told him when we got to Chicago, Dan showed up to the sound check with a bunch of basses, and told me, said, pick one. So I picked one, and actually the one I picked was this bass here that's behind me. I picked that one, and after getting it, I didn't like the neck, because my P neck has worn down. It was really worn. It really felt really good. This neck was brand new, and it just didn't feel comfortable to me. So I never really actually played it unless I had to, so I eventually got. Dan called me up after, it was a couple of years later, called me up and said, I'll make you a bass, Well, I know what it was. I know what got that there. there was was my 60th birthday. And my manager, my then manager at the time, called Fender and he wanted to have a signature bass made for me. Yep. And but Fender turned him down. And somebody on, we were on, I guess this was the beginning of Facebook maybe. We were talking about, somebody said, man, if you had a signature bass, I would definitely buy it, And so I told him the story about Fender turning me down, and boy, Fender got trashed.
I bet, man.
So
that's some bad PR right there.
Yeah, I didn't know that Dan was actually checking me out, because he wasn't listed as a friend. So I got this message, this personal message from Dan Lakeland saying that I'll make you a bass. Send me your bass, and we'll take it from there. And I said, I'm sorry, man, but I'm not sending my bass no way.
Yeah.
I'm not sending this bass to nobody. But I'll take it to someone down here to have the dimensions done, and to send you the dimensions of the neck and everything. And I did that. And he, about 6-8 months later, he sent me the other bass. Well, that bass is downstairs. But that bass eventually replaced my P bass.
Okay.
Because at that point, well, two things about it that I really liked was that it was lighter than my P bass, and it felt like my P bass because the neck was my P bass.
He just copied the neck specs exactly.
Exactly, and so that's the way that bass became a thing. And then shortly after that, Dan left the company. He sold the company and walked away from it. Lakeland was, it was a Bob Glob bass. Basically, that one is just Bob Glob. This is a P bass that they just custom to my neck. Well, I took the original P bass, the original Bob Glob that Dan gave me, and took that to the guys down here in New Orleans that took the dimensions of my neck and had them redo this neck. So like this neck, and then I also gave them that No Name bass.
Yeah.
I gave them the No Name bass and said, man, make that bass like that too.
while you're at it.
I put my P bass neck on two other instruments. So then I had three basses that felt like my P bass. Which was cool.
So is there a George Porter signature bass now, like a Lakeland or anything?
Not yet. But when Dan started D Lakeland, he gave me a D Lakeland bass, his first run on a D Lakeland bass, which is very much, he says it's a P bass. But everybody I talk to says, no, that's a jazz bass. Mm. And but Dan says it was the original P bass. And so I never was into the technical parts of how those basses came or how they evolved. I just played them.
yeah. Can you tell me about the first time that you got your original, like your P bass, maybe like what year that was and where you got it and what it was about that instrument that like really worked for you in the way that you played?
Well, it was 1970. 1970, I bought, because all before 1970, I was playing Gibsons.
Oh, really?
I played the EB. I had all of the EB series.
Really?
Okay. I had,
like on the first Meters record, that would be a Gibson?
Those were Gibsons, yes.
Really?
Until Cabbage Alley. Well, actually, Chicken Strut.
That's where you switched?
Strutting was when we were in Atlanta, Georgia, and at the Lefevre studio. And the son Marlon had a Telecaster, and it was in the wall, sitting up against the wall, and my EB3 was kind of like not in good shape anymore.
Really?
And it wasn't staying in tune, and the engineer said, "Why don't you pull that Telecaster out of the corner over there and see how that it ain't been, it had spider webs on the thing. It probably ain't been used in it forever." So I yanked it out of the corner, wiped it down, and cleaned it up and plugged it up and tuned it up.
It was a Tele bass.
A Tele bass, yes.
Yeah.
And I still have that bass. It hasn't left the house in well over 25 years. It hasn't left my house since 1976.
Wow.
Because I had a dream that I lost it. I went looking for it that morning and I couldn't find it. And what had happened was that I was still getting high back then. And one of my cocaine blitz, I went outside. I opened the trunk of the car to put the basses in the trunk of the car, and somebody came out of the club and opened the door, and the door opened all the way. The other bass was against the wall.
Oh shit!
And the door covered the wall, so I looked behind and didn't see the bass. So I figured Bradley had taken the bass and put it in the truck. So I didn't worry about that. I just split because I was I had a date with some cocaine. And so I split, went to bed that night and woke up the next morning and just had a dream that I left that bass behind. I saw what had happened,
I
knew exactly where it was. And that's where it was. But Bradley and them, when they closed up the joint, the bass came visible and Bradley did take the bass home. And
wow.
It was like three. The third phone call was to Bradley. You know where that bass is? And he said, "Yeah, I got it. You left it on the wall in front of the club." I said, "Oh man, that was the last day that bass came out of the house." Until several times that I moved, the bass came out of the house. But it was, and I played on that bass. Some fans was questioning on Facebook a few months ago about how many instruments, how many bass guitars I have. And I said, "I don't know, that's a good question. I know there's some out in the country and there's a few here in the city. Okay, I'm gonna do what? I'm gonna go out, I'm gonna take this day, go out to the country tomorrow, and we're gonna go look up and see what we got." So I went out there and pulled out, there was five basses out there and the Telecaster was one of them. And so
okay.
I plugged them up and I played all five of those basses, and just introduced those basses to everyone.
Yeah.
And then came back to the house and did the same thing here in New Orleans,
So your recording bass originally was the EB, the Gibson, and then the Tele that was just hanging on the guy's wall became your main instrument for a while?
That bass recorded Strutton yep. LP and the Cabbage Alley LP.
Wow, amazing.
So, I'm thinking it must have been 1971. I wanted a fretless bass. So I went bought the Precision fretless bass. And that bass was, I bought it in 71, but it was a 1970 Precision fretless bass.
Okay.
And I bought it and made the mistake of taking it on the road and leaving the telly at home. And we were out for a couple of months with the meters, and all I was doing was slipping and sliding up that deck.
Oh my God. What made you want to get into the fretless thing all of a sudden?
I think somebody, I think it was had something to do with probably Jaco. I'm not sure, because I don't play like Jaco, but it was a sound that he had, that Zig and or Leo both was, saying, boy, that's a great sound,
You got to get that Jaco thing.
So it was, and I went to several cases with both Zig and Leo where, they wanted me to sound like, get the sound that bass player is getting, one was the Johnson brother, they wanted me to get his bass sound. I never knew what instrument he played or anything. And I just told them they go screw themselves. I said, I'm not, if you want that sound, hire him,
You got the George Porter sound right here.
They kind of left that alone. But twice it was Jaco and it was the Johnson brother. I don't even remember the kid's name.
So did you end up putting frets onto that bass, or did you just get a new bass?
No, I got a neck. A music store here in New Orleans, Rock and Roll Music. The owner had an instrument that had the neck. The body had been cut. And they were just trying to sell the neck, and I bought the neck for $50. It was a precision bass, and I just took the neck off it. I bought the neck for $50, and that neck got put onto my fretless bass in 1971.
And that became the bass
up until the Lakelands came along.
That's cool. That's a great history. And I didn't know that you played Gibsons originally. You mentioned some of those early recordings, and I wonder if you could just talk for a minute about, like, coming as a bass player, the concept of a rhythm section, and how you've played with some great drummers over the years, obviously, and your relationship with Zigaboo and those early years must have been pretty intense. Can you maybe just talk about how, and also Russell Batiste, like in more recent years, and there's probably a bunch of other drummers that you've loved playing with, but could you just maybe talk a little bit about that concept as a whole, like finding the right people and gelling as a rhythm section, how that's happened to you and who your favorite players have been to play with in that sense?
Well, I've been very fortunate to actually being playing with probably the high end New Orleans drummers.
Yeah.
By all means, starting all the way back is with Zigaboo but before Zigaboo, there was a young man named Albert Brown. No, not Albert Brown. What about Albert now? Albert Smith.
Okay.
And he was a singer that played drums. And he had it was a serious cover band back in there. But he was a very solid drummer, Nothing fancy, but he was just solid, Then at that time I was a guitar player, not a bass player. I was a guitar player.
Oh, okay.
But being aware of how drums related to bass.
Yep.
Because I was playing guitar, but I was also I knew how to play bass too at the time. I just developed that idea that when the bass and drums are playing together off of each other, that everything else in the band, just can do anything. It can gel, you know, because bass and drums is so. So that probably was the thing,
it's the foundation.
Yeah, that's what probably, you know, drew me to wanting to be more predominantly a bass player. But it was basically really the Vietnam conflict that happened, the draft that pretty much got me to playing bass more and more because I was, you know, a lot of the younger players were getting drafted, and I couldn't touch my toes. I was told that I had a crooked spine.
And that
I could, you know, I was drafted. I was brought down to be drafted. And it's the only reason why I didn't go to the military, because I couldn't touch my toes.
Wow.
And because it wasn't a war, it wasn't on paper as a war, then, you know, my injury kept me home. You know,
But
if it had been a war,
whatever it takes, man.
Yeah, if it had been a war, I would have been overseas.
Wow, that's crazy.
But
there was like a lack of bass players around New Orleans at the time.
There was a lack of electric bass players. Yes.
Wow. So we're talking like 67, 68 here.
No, I'm talking earlier than that.
Okay.
I can't put my finger on. And my numbers on my years is all screwed up. I was playing bass with Irvin Bannister, who just recently passed away. In fact, I was playing bass with him. It must have been around 63, 64, maybe.
Wow. Okay. Just around New Orleans, or were you touring with him?
No, just in New Orleans. I was local. I was the first band to take me out of the city. Out of Louisiana, let's put it that way. Because with Herbert Wing's band, The Taste of New Orleans, when Papi couldn't go on those little runs to Baton Rouge to play on the fraternity houses up in Baton Rouge with Earl King or Benny Spellman, one of those guys, I would go up and I would be the bass player on Herbert's brain. And all of that probably could have happened in 64, 65. When we started at the Nightcap, when Art Neville saw me playing with Urban's band, that was right after the Tell It Like It Is. Aaron had been out on the road with supporting Tell It Like It Is. And that's the only way I can tell. I don't know what year that was. I can just say it happened after Tell It Like It Is. So whatever year Tell It Like It Is was the big hit for Aaron.
Yeah, it's probably around 64, 65.
65, right? Somewhere in that neighborhood. That Art came home and saw me playing bass with Irvin Bannister and said, "Hey, man, that's the instrument you should have been playing." Because the very first time I played with Art, I was a guitar player. And he hated it. He told me on the way. He told me on the way home that, you know, when he dropped me off at home, he said, "Man, you're the worst guitar player I ever." You know,
thanks, Art.
I didn't play solos. I was a rhythm guitar player. He wasn't a soloist on piano. He just played chords to back up his vocals. So whenever the time was a solo come up, he would look at me and I say, "Ah."
Can you give me a taste of what the live music scene in New Orleans in the mid 60s was like? Like, was it focused around Bourbon Street? Like, Bourbon Street was kind of happening and cool back then, right? Like, it wasn't a weird party scene like it is now.
Bourbon Street was, every club on Bourbon Street back then had a live band, usually three bands, you know, throughout the course of the day. Three bands would play instead of like now they have one band that pretty much play from 1 o'clock in the daytime until, you know, until they tell him he can go home at night, you know? So yeah. There were other clubs in the city, smaller black clubs that mm-hmm. the music scene that, you know, that I was part of. Clubs like
what were some of the main ones?
Well, the band was the 808, Club 77. That was much later. Lou and Charlie's Camp much later, but it was kind of based off of those old original clubs. There was the GTO club. That's where Art saw me playing with Irvin at the GTO. But I started playing in those little clubs because, you know, before with Herbert's band, we were playing fraternity houses. We weren't playing nightclubs. It was Herbert had every weekend he was on Broadway playing one of those frat houses the whole weekend. He would play one night and two blocks down the next night, you know.
That's where the gigs were, was the frat houses?
That's where the gigs was. And then when we weren't on Broadway in New Orleans, we would go up to LSU in Baton Rouge. So the 808 was an uptown club. That was the Club 77 was a downtown, club. And the GTO was kind of like in the middle between the two, you know, between uptown and downtown, which, you know, I'm talking about, you know, probably 10 to 12 miles apart, the difference between the 808 and the Club 77. And then the GTO was like right in the middle, you know.
And like Tipitina's and Maple Leaf and those places were not around at that point?
I was unaware of the Maple Leaf Club at the time. Tipitina's was, it wasn't Tipitina's then, back then. It was called 501. And it was there, but it was not a biker club, but it was like, you know, the good old boys club, you know. They used to throw beer bottles at the black guys, and you know, we'd come over there, buy drinks in a little window, you know, but you can go buy a quarter beer in the window.
Yeah.
And when you're crossing a Notre Dame going home, somebody throw a beer bottle at you, you know, from the club. What happens? That was the way it was back then. So a lot of guys learned how to run really well from that, you know.
When was the first time that you got together with Zigaboo and Art and Leo? Like when did the Meters actually become a band? Was that 65 or 66?
That was 66. I want to say, you know, I had to be, Leo said, the other day in the interview, I heard Leo say it was 65. But we started playing at the club called the Nightcap. And that was, again, that was like in the middle between uptown and downtown. It's right in the middle. And there were, you know, and I can't know the names of them, but there were jazz clubs back in the 60s in New Orleans that was, you know, that I wasn't a part of that neighborhood because I wasn't considering myself a jazz musician. And so I didn't go to those clubs. But the Nightcap was going to be an R&B night spot and popular music at the time, popular R&B music. Art got that gig. Leo and the saxophone player was in the band. It was Sam Henry's band that when Art got there, Art sat in one night with them. On Sam Harris B3, mm-hmm. and basically the club owner, you know, pretty much gave Art the gig, you know, Art
really?
and hijacked Sam's band.
That's the way to do it.
And hijacked the band, kept Leo Nocentelli, kept Gary Brown, the saxophone player, and hired a drummer named Glenn. Played drums and brought me in on bass, and we played like that for a few months, and then Glenn had to go off to have a minor surgery, and for them 2 weeks he was gone. Art recruited Zigaboo from the Deacon Johns band. Well, at that point, Deacon Johns was he was kind of moving away from the strict R&B big horn band thing to a rock kind of Jimi Hendrix, you know, Led Zeppelin, you know, band. He was he started playing metal, and you know, he got big amplifiers and stuff. Deke was probably one of the first black rock bands in New Orleans, you know, Zig was in that band. Mm-hmm. And Zig was in the band that was transitioning. I don't think Zig played the rock part of the gig yet, but you know, maybe some of the Jimi Hendrix stuff, but not the rock part. Zig came in. When Glenn came back to that Sunday, 2 weeks later, he came in on a Sunday, and we were playing. Joint was packed, and he heard Zigaboo playing his drums, And he turned to the club owner and told him, said, man, I don't think I'm going to get this gig back.
And he was right.
Yeah. And the next day, man, he came and removed his drums. And I'd never seen him again.
Holy shit. Wow.
And I can't remember his last name, you know.
Wow.
But he was a wonderful drummer. I enjoyed playing with him for that, you know, for 5 or 6 months, you know, that he was on that gig. He was a good drummer.
And so when Zigaboo came and sat in and that happened, like, did it gel really quickly? Like, did you guys lock in and just like,
It was immediate. Zig had a feel that none of us had played with before, you know.
Tell me about that.
And it was a pocket that it was his. It was Zigaboo. You know, he came from the street. He knew how to play that street parade stuff. You know, he knew what that was about. But you know, he incorporated that with, you know, the other styles of music that he had ingested.
Yeah.
And you know, he came up with a way of playing all this stuff that was just totally new. Right. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. I would love to see it written down, but I don't think nobody can write that.
It's true, man. You know, like, he's one of those players that, and you are too, I think, where people like hear what you do and they love it and they kind of copy it, but often just get it wrong.
Yeah.
And he's one of those guys, like, everyone plays, you know, Sissy Strut or whatever. Like, there's a lot of people that play those songs, but they never really play them right.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the biggest problems that most drummers had with playing that Sissy Strut was they did the hi-hat section with one hand.
Right.
And Zig played that with two hands. You know, it was a two-handed thing. And
fluid.
And that was just the difference of how that accent for doing it with one hand, you know.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
It probably, you know, the guys who got it right probably made them better drummers just because they were able to do something with one hand, you know, gave them a better wrist, you know. But you know, it was like most of the times it was played wrong.
You know, if you guys got together around 66, your first record, as far as I know, came out in 69. Was it just like a couple of years where you guys were hardcore playing gigs like night after night in frat houses? And
that band, before it became the Meters, we played the Nightcap nightclub. And after a couple of years of doing that, we went on Bourbon Street and we played Bourbon Street for a couple of years.
And what were you playing? Like, what was the material you guys were playing?
We were playing everything from Curtis Mayfield. We played everything from Earl King to Fats Domino to the Five Stairs, not the Five Stair Steps, up the group that did Up, Up and Away. I can't remember Up and Away. Yeah, there was
I know the song.
Yeah, they West Montgomery stuff. We were playing music. We were a bona fide cover band, and it was the fact that we had been putting in so much time together as a rhythm section. When we started doing those sessions with Alan Toussaint, you know, we got refined even more so because Alan taught me more than anybody, I think, about my bass lines having more space. I was pretty locked into his left hand almost on all of those Lee Dorsey records. Almost any record that we played with Alan, my left hand, my bass line was in his left hand. And, you know, so I learned about that part about what not to play versus what to play, you know.
Did Alan see you guys down like at a gig on Bourbon Street and say, like, I want you guys to come in and be like, because
he had been seeing us from the Nightcap. He used to visit the Nightcap and see us. And then when we went on Bourbon Street, the doorman at when we were going on a break, he would tell and say, your boy in a Cadillac was outside.
So did he just start inviting you guys down to play sessions for him as a producer? Is that
his manager called us, call Art up Because I believe Art had worked with Alan in the previous years. Also, Leo had worked with Alan in his younger days. You know, he called Marshall called Art and said, "Alan would like to see you guys come in to do an audition." You know, and we went into audition to play some music. It was eventually that music turned into being the Lee Dorsey record.
Okay.
And that's how, you know, that's how we became Alan Toussaint's house band.
What was your relationship with him? He was probably a little older than you guys. And did he really, was he really hands-on? Like you mentioned that he kind of taught you about space and what are some of the other things that he, that you learned from him, like as a producer and as a music person?
Well, you know, as a, he was hands-on on anything that he was writing for other artists and the artists that he was not hands-on in the Meters catalog. He left the Meters to the Meters. He never, you know, eventually it was how it went down was it was an Alan Toussaint session. We didn't always know who the artist was going to be because we would just go in, record the tracks with Alan, you know, talking.
Oh, without the artist there.
Yeah, without the artist there. Oh, and, okay. And then later the record come out with somebody on it, you know. Yeah. But it was after one of those sessions at Cosmos Matassa Studio that Jazz City, I believe the name of that studio was, Marshall Sehorn walked into the room and told us to say, so Alan is finished for the day. Why don't y'all play something? You know, why don't y'all lay down a couple of tracks, you know, do something. So that's what how it went down.
So had you guys worked out some instrumentals and stuff as the Meters already, or was it just strictly like...
It happened right there in the studio. Well,
wow.
Sophisticated Sissy was sort of like a pocket that we played as a break song at the Ivanhoe. 1-2 minutes while Art would say, yeah, and we'll take a short part for Word of Cause and we'll end the song. So that's the that's with that groove. We in the studio that day, Leo put that intro. He put that intro that little intro on the song. He also came up with that lick, the Sissy Strut lick. Then I think the other two songs. One was basically a Turkey in the Straw.
Really?
Sehorn's farm was basically Turkey in the Straw. And Here Come the Meter Man, I think that was Zig's pocket. Zig set up a groove and we just started playing, you know. And pretty much the next two albums, I mean, with the album that was Sissy Strut's album and the Look of Pie Pie album was pretty much we go in with some licks, somebody bring in a lick and we make a song from it.
Was there any discussion among you guys about like how it would evolve as a sound? Because like it's a very strong concept. The Meters were like very melodic and very groove based, but it wasn't like you just played the song and then a wild jam broke out. It was like very restrained and very funky, but in a restrained, interesting kind of way. Like, did you guys figure that out at all, or was it just you just played and just let it happen?
Well, I kind of remember little parts about how, you know, one of the things was that almost all of those songs were all under 3 minutes long.
Yeah,
and so you know they if there was a solo, it only happened one time.
Right.
You know, pass at it, and you know, and so you know, there was, you know, it was basically about that lick and that groove. Leo was, used to always say that in everything from the second album on, the instrumentals were beds looking for heads.
Okay.
You know, that's the reason why there was so many Meter songs that was the hip hop community picked up on, because they were, you know, there was a rhythm track looking for something to go on top of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of those songs lean to that, you know. So no, the answer to your question, not really. I don't think there was a designated concentrated effort to go in and do this. It was just things that happen. It is things that happen. We start playing, you know, and so, like I said, somebody would come up with a lick. Most of the times it was Leo. He would come up with a lick, and we'll just build on it, and you know, and usually Marshall would kind of say, "Okay, stop," you know. So we might take two takes at some of them songs. We'd say, "Okay, well, yeah, that's ended there," or something like that, or they would fade it, you know.
And was it always done at that at Cosmo's studio?
The very first one was done at Kyle's studio. The second two were done in Atlanta, Georgia, at the LeFevre studio. So Look at Pie Pie and Strutton was recorded in Atlanta, Georgia.
Why didn't you do those in New Orleans?
We didn't have a studio there yet. Cosmo had studio closed. Marshall and Alan was in the process of building a studio. Hadn't got it was in the plans and the money was being put together, but they wanted to move, and Alan wanted to move to a multi-track studio. See, Kyle's studio wasn't multi-track. It was multi-track per se, but it wasn't you know, where we had a mixing desk.
You couldn't overdub to
like the real world. They had those capabilities, but it was done old school. Like, you run the tape and just run a new machine and run it all the sounds over. Yes. So Alan wanted to start using multi-track stuff because he was getting big work, you know, from record labels wanting him to produce their artists. So he had to move to a better studio. So we moved to the LeFevre studio and we did the Lee Dorsey stuff there. We did some Betty Harris stuff there. We did, I can't remember who his name was there, but we got some work done there, but mostly Lee Dorsey and the Meters.
So when you did those early Meters records, were you guys all in the same room, just like straight up playing together?
Not much farther away from AR right now in this room.
Yeah. And you weren't overdubbing anything. It was all just straight live off the floor, all that stuff.
Yes. Yes.
I know, like, you guys had a lot of success with that first record. It kind of happened right away. And it was kind of an unusual thing because, I mean, really the only other band doing anything like you would have been like Booker T and the MGs.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Up in Memphis.
Right.
But did you guys start touring all over the States and
we started touring almost immediately. Yeah. After the song was released and, Marshall came in and called us. It was Sophisticated Sissy.
Yeah.
And Marshall called us into the office and handed a big check for each one of us. A check for $20,000. He gave us $20,000 each. And
that's a lot of money back then.
And he handed us a contract about that thick. and say, you don't have to read it, you know, it's just everything in there to protect you guys, you know, sign on the last page and you get to keep that check, you know. And, you know, first of all, I ain't never seen $20,000, and you know, I never seen a piece of paper with $20,000 wrote on it that had my name on it, let's put it that way. And I signed. I didn't have any qualms on signing.
He was counting on you. Have never seen that much money.
Exactly. Exactly.
So did you guys kind of get ripped off then? Like, I don't know the.
Oh yeah, we signed our publishing over. We didn't sign. Apparently, we did not sign our copyrights. So we owned all our songs, but we signed over the publishing.
Wow.
And the masters.
Yeah.
So, which was like, you know, which like, and today is, you know, it's the first things you want to sign, you want to keep is publishing and masters, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So yeah, we kind of got screwed on that in that sense, you know, and it took almost 30 years before we actually got our publishing right. And we really didn't get our publishing back. Our publishing just went to a company that started paying us.
Okay. So what was the touring situation like back in those days? Like, were you guys slogging it out in vans and stuff, or like, was it Like how well were you doing across the country?
In a Volkswagen, not a Volkswagen, but in a Mercury station wagon with a little trailer on the back. Yeah.
Wow.
You know,
hardcore.
And we did the Chitlin' Circuit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Did the band take to touring well, or was it bad for you guys, or like how did you guys fare?
I think that we fared pretty good. I don't remember gripes, anybody bitching about being out, you know. Whenever you say we was going home, everybody was happy about that. But, you know, we were out playing, and for the time, at that time, we were making our fairly decent money, you know. We were getting more money on a nightly basis than we were getting playing on a nightly basis at home. Let's put it that way. So everybody was okay with that.
And were you keeping your studio work up when you got home, or did that kind of reach the point where you would be gone and then people would sort of forget about you in New Orleans?
No. What it was, how that worked, Marshall controlled our whole thing. When we weren't needed in the studio for Alan, he had us on the road.
Yeah.
And the booking agency at the time was Phil Walden.
The Capricorn guy.
He would bring us home. He would just call up and say, I need him home, you know, this next 3 weeks, you know. And we would come home for those 3 weeks and be in the studio. We may get a couple of little gigs around town, but for the most part, we weren't working when we was at home. We would be in the studio.
Okay. I mean, the meter sort of lasted through the 80s and stuff. Like, at what point did you guys actually call it quits?
The meters didn't make it through the 80s. Art left the band in 79.
Oh, it was 79. Okay, yeah.
He left the band in 79, started his Neville Brothers project. I left the band in the late part of 79. We did a reunion in 1980 that featured four bands. Zig had a band called Gaboon's Gang, and had started recording with that band. And the only person that didn't have a band was Leo. I had a band called Joyride that I had started recording with.
Oh, yeah.
And Art had the Neville Brothers. So each one of those bands played, and then the original Meters played together as a band. And we're talking about, at that time, it was the original band, and I think we brought Aaron Neville out as a singer. I believe Cyril was on that gig, too. And we had background singers. And I believe they had a horn section. I kind of believe that video's footage camp surfaced for a few minutes a couple of years ago. The Foo Fighters guy did a piece where he used some footage from that concert in his New Orleans part of that.
Oh, in the Sound City show that was. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
In 1980, that was it. And then I think after that show, the Meters kind of disappeared, you know, as a group called the Meters, you know, it just went away. Everybody pretty much did his thing. I was doing much. I kind of left Joyride, did nothing for a few years, and then was playing music on the street with David Lasseter and his family. And playing jazz, playing, you know, bebop and New Orleans traditional jazz. Yeah.
What else has the future got in store for you? Like, assuming that all this stuff kind of clears up and that we can go back to working at some point as musicians, are you going to, like, do you enjoy leading your own band more than anything else? Or do you still do any sideman gigs or sessions for other people? Or, like, what else are you up to?
I'm doing a little of all of that, yes. I get a lot of work, you know, as a solo artist with other groups, you know, guest artists or guest appearance, or the bass player, you know, like Warren Hans has called me several times, and I'm just the bass player in that organization that he does when he does that project. Steve Kimmock calls me a lot, the Voodoo Dead project. I kind of moved up in the organization when we go overseas to Japan or stuff like that, I'm the front singer in that band.
Oh, cool.
In New Orleans, when we do the shows here in New Orleans and doing Jazz Fest, I'm myself and we switch off between Jackie Greene and Lebo. Mm-hmm. As the lead singers, one or the other, whoever's not there, the other one is there. And then we've been using another guy. I can't think of his name. God, forget him. But it's like three lead singers that Kim Mock uses, and mostly the guys that kind of have a handle on this Grateful Dead
right.
catalog. Then I've done three or four bass solo, not solos, but both bass overdubs where people send me their files and I do the work here in the house. And I do my bass lines and send it back to them and get paid. And that's a nice income. For 35, 40 minutes work, you know.
Yeah, man.
For future, I'm really looking forward to getting back into work. But only when it's really safe before I call myself wants to be in a room full of hundreds of people. You know, it's gonna be a
while. What's happening with Jazz Fest? Have they canceled it for this year, or are they?
I think they're talking about later on in the year. Like October or something like that. That's what I heard. That's a rumor. You can't hold me to that one.
Okay,
but. Getting back out, I kind of said this at one of the gigs a couple of weeks ago that I think I was going to take both bands out on the road at the same time, you know, to pull the trio and Running Partners, you know, and do like each night I'd do two sets, you know, one set would be Running Partners and the next set would be a trio, and then alternate every night, every other night or so, I'll switch up, you know, and so you got both bands and I keep everybody working, you know.
Sure.
And the whole idea, all it takes is just have one additional person on the road. That seems safe. I have a nice Ford van that was designed for one of the sprinters. All my gear, all of our gear packs into the back of this vehicle. And the six captain chairs in the front, you know, and we travel really well. I was different on my vehicle and then most of the vehicles you'll see out there is that I have four wheels on the back of my vehicle instead of just the two wheels. But so the rear end of the rear end axle is more sturdy and I can handle the weight, you know, of the gear.
I'm curious, what's your take on Jazz Fest? As somebody that's probably seen it for the last 60 years or whatever it is, how it's evolved into the size that it is now. Like, does it feel still like a really vital and real part of your year? Or is it just like so out of control that it's, I'm not talking about this year, but like in general, just kind of like where it's gone?
Well, you know, from an artist point of view, I don't see it has evolved out of control. If you're speaking from an audience point of view, the crowd is no more. It's not as comfortable as it used to be.
Right.
When the crowds weren't as big as they are.
Yeah.
I mean, the bigger the crowds get, the more uncomfortable it would get and naturally. But as a musician, as an artist that plays the festival, that's played every one of them, I think I only missed two or maybe three at the most. But I missed two of them was canceled. It was canceled. And one, I was on the road with David Byrne and I couldn't make it. I don't see an artist being inconvenience that as far as how Jazz Fest is being, how large no matter how big it gets, it's seemingly the artists the way the artist is handled and presented is still a good thing, you know, and I can speak from that point because I was a stage manager out there for 15 years. I was a stage manager on both of the big stages for 15 years.
Wow.
So I knew how it was supposed to go and how it did go, you know. So
right. Well, hey, George, thank you so much for talking to me today, man. I really appreciate it and love hearing the stories. And, you know, you've just contributed so much to music that I love hearing all this stuff. And thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thank you for having me. And all right, don't forget, look out for Crying for Hope. It's out there.
Yeah, man. Looking forward to everything else you do, and hope to see you out in the live music world one of these days again.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That was my conversation with George Porter Jr. Hope you enjoyed it. I had a blast talking to him. And he has a new record out, Crying for Hope. Go check it out. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.